Well, today we are beginning the next story. As we're going through the Bible, we've talked about creation and we talked about how things got messed up. And today we're going to look at the flood, Noah and the flood, the guy with a bunch of animals in a boat that saved humanity. Now, there are a few stories in the Bible that are more familiar than the story of the flood. And yet, there are a few stories that have more ridicule and are more doubted than the flood. And so I just want to say right off the bat, my bias, when I approach a story that the Bible tells, I assume that it really happened, unless there's a really compelling reason why it looks like it was intended as a parable. And so I don't just come in and go, this happened exactly the way it says, no matter what. I try to look at it and ascertain that. Now, in this case, I understand there are some things about the story that you might go, that sounds crazy. Things like the whole world being covered by water, things like animals getting in pairs and coming onto the ark and things like that. I understand why that might be problematic. And you may even have studied enough history to know that most civilizations, most cultures have a flood myth in their background. And so you go, oh, they're just making a story just like the Babylonians and everyone else did. Now, some of these things can be seen both ways. For one thing, you're not going to make up something that's ridiculous and try to pass it off as truth. Also, the fact that every culture has had a flood myth might make you wonder if there wasn't a flood back there somewhere that they all told the story that it was passed down. But as we look at it, I'll try to explain to you that it's not nearly as ridiculous as it might first sound. I believe this story actually happened. I see it as being very plausible. But at the same time, if you just go, it's just a fairy tale, well, that's okay with me. I don't care if people agree with seeing the Bible the way I do. I'm just telling you how I see it and what's reasonable for me. And you can choose to take it any way you want, but at least look at it and listen to the story and see what's there for you. Now, the story starts in Genesis chapter 6. And it starts on kind of a weird thing, and it's a controversial passage. I'm not going to put a bunch into it. The whole point is, man, was the world really messed up. But where it starts in Genesis 6, verse 1, it says, came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. Not anything too weird about that, but he goes on and says, the Lord said, my spirit will not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. And then there were giants in the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, those were the mighty men who were of old men of renown. Now, hang on a minute here. This is one of the passages, these four verses, that you get questioned about constantly. Because it doesn't really say exactly what it means. Who are the sons of God? Who are the daughters of men? What do they have to do with giants? Why is this so bad? So there are different interpretations of this passage. Now, what makes it so funny is that one of the major potential interpretations of it that's very old is that the sons of God were here actually fallen angels, demonic creatures, who came down and had sex with human women. And then they had this hybrid race, half demon, half human, and they became giants, and that was what the flood was all about. There are other possible explanations of this. It could just be talking about the fact that as the population grew, problems persisted. It also could be that people who were from the righteous line of Seth ended up intermarrying with people who were really heathen and pagan. So I don't know. I don't know what it means, to be honest with you. Not sure. But for me, one of my rules of hermeneutics is if there are several different possible interpretations of a passage, I don't go with the one that sounds just totally crazy to me. So I'm doubting the whole demons and human sex monster thing. It could be, I don't know, but I think that there are other explanations that work fine with this passage as well. And besides that, there are some things that really mitigate against that position. For instance, Jesus says essentially that angels are sexless beings, and so it would be pretty hard. Plus, it says there were giants in those days, but it says there were giants later too. So the giants weren't necessarily the fruit of this hybridization, genetic engineering, and all that kind of stuff. Also, if that was the case, God would have been really mad at demons and would have done something to destroy them. But what it turns out is God's mad at people. And in this case, the people, if you take that interpretation, they would have just been victimized. But the whole thing comes down to, beginning with verse 5, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. So this sets the stage. First of all, God says, people are so messed up, destroying each other. And mankind is going to be wiped out if something doesn't happen. God's so patient, though. He says, I'll give you 120 years to get your act together. I mean, what a 120-year warning? But that's what he says. But then he explains the people that he had created are going to destroy themselves because they're killing each other, you know, just rampantly. And so he's like, I may have to do something to save humanity, and it may involve destroying most of them. Now, that sounds like, well, that's not logical. But if people are bad, and there was only one good guy, and if bad people are killing other bad people, eventually the bad people are going to kill the good person. And when that happens, society is doomed, because ultimately there is no more thread of righteousness even possible. And so in their case, it goes way back to Cain and Abel killing each other. And after that, people just saw, wow, this is interesting. We can kill each other. And so in those days, perhaps even more so than today, the potential of mankind wiping itself out was very real. And so God ends up stepping into this and going, this is so disgusting. I'm going to have to do something radical. And so I'm going to save mankind by destroying the bulk of mankind. And not only that, I'm going to destroy most of the animals, but I'm going to preserve all the species of animals, as you know the story goes. Now, I don't know why he's picking on the animals, but he does. And I think that perhaps there are things that the story doesn't tell us about the role of animals in their sinful lifestyle. And, you know, I don't know, you can use your imagination. It could be that people were worshiping the animals and that was a problem. I don't know. But at any rate, God desperately needs to step into the picture to fix this. But I want to call your attention before we get into the story to verse 6. Describes God's emotions at a time when he saw how bad things were on the earth. And all their thoughts were bad, and they were just constantly evil. The Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. And down at the end of verse 7, I am sorry that I even made them. Now, usually when people teach this, they'll just discount this. They'll be like, nah, God couldn't be sorry because he's perfect and he knows everything. And so often I hear people teaching on this passage and they say, that's an anthropomorphism. Now, an anthropomorphism, which comes from morph, which means a physical form, and anthropos, which is mankind, There are times in the Bible when the Bible uses a physical description of God in order to describe God in a way that we will understand him, and that's an anthropomorphism. For instance, God spreads his wings over the people that he loves, or the eyes of God move to and fro, or the hand of God was on him, or so on. We understand this is a figure of speech. It's an anthropomorphism. Now, in this case, it's nothing physical, so it really isn't an anthropomorphism. It would be an anthropopathism, which is to take human emotion and feeling and impute it to God in order to explain it. But how about this? How about we just believe what God says about himself? If God says he was sorry, that he had mixed emotions about even having made people, and we're created in his image, we're capable of these kind of emotions, do you really think it's a sin to feel? Do you really think it's a sin to be going, I mean, come on, you who have had kids, wasn't there a time when you go, man, I don't even know if I should have done this or not? You know, you don't kill your kids, but you feel that way. So the way I look at it, God is in a position, God who's undoubtedly more sensitive than we are. Now, I believe that God knows the future, nothing surprises him, all that stuff too. But I also believe that he tells the truth. I'm amazed at people who totally believe the whole story of the ark, but right here, they don't believe that God could feel something like this. I see a God who was just torn. A God who looked at the situation going, I love these people. And I love this planet. I remember what it was like when I made it. But they're going to kill themselves. They're going to wipe out society. And as a result, the promises that I've made to bring from the seed of Eve somebody who will destroy Satan, that is being jeopardized by the way that things are. God, when he did this, did not find it easy. It was hard. It was emotional for him. He felt. And when you feel, that's a part of the image of God that even allows you to do that. I mean, animals don't have such feelings. They don't make plans for the future. They don't really get that disappointed in things. This is something that the Bible says God was that way. So here you have it. You have one good guy left. That's it. How do you save humanity for the future? How do you do that? How is it that you will ever be able to have a culture created that could then, God could be born into that culture and become one of us, ultimately live a perfect life and die for us, and then crush the head of Satan forever? You can't do that without people. And so God had to do something desperate, and his solution was what we call the flood. And so he talks to Noah, and he says, I have grace on you. You're the only good guy left. So what I want you to do, you got to understand this, you need to build a boat. And you need to make it so big that every species of animal can be included on it. And you and your wife and your kids' wives are going to then be put on that boat. A flood's going to cover the earth, and ultimately you will start society all over again, just with you, because you're the only one I have left. Now, we don't know how, we know that when God said, you have 120 years and then it's over. So that must have been about the time that he spoke to Noah, which Noah would have been at the time about 480 years old. It was another 20 years before Noah had his first kid at Ham at the age of 500. We'll talk about that later. Don't let that throw you off too much. So he would have had as much as 120 years to build a boat, or as little as 40, 50 years. Could have done it easily. 2 Peter chapter 2 tells us that he was a preacher. So Noah's building a boat, and he's preaching to people. Now, you know, a lot of times as a pastor, you preach and it seems like nobody really gets it, and it can be kind of frustrating. Imagine preaching for 120 years and the only converts are your wife, your three boys, and their wives. And they may just be going along for the cruise. Who knows? We don't know what their heart was, and one of them was definitely questionable. But So he begins to build the ark. Now, we look as this unfolds, and we see there later on in chapter 6, kind of the design of the ark. Here are the instructions that God gave him. And God said in verse 13, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark. Cover it inside and outside with pitch. Seal it really good. And this is how you shall make it." Here's the plans for the ark. "The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits." A cubit's about 18 inches, so that's like 450 feet long. He says, "And the width, 50 cubits, 75 feet wide. And the height, 30 cubits, 45 feet high. You shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it to a cubit from above and set the door of the ark in its side. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. And behold, I myself am bringing floodwaters on the earth to destroy them from under heaven. All flesh in which is the breath of life, everything that's on the earth is going to die." Everything that isn't in the ark. Now, it's interesting. Experts have looked at this and said, if you wanted to make a vessel that big to survive this kind of storm, this is a really good plan for it. This is an optimal size. Now, there are other creation myths that are out there, like the Babylonians had an ark, a myth of an ark, but theirs was a cube. Can you imagine being in stormy waters and it's just, whoa, and it's just flipping over? That's a made-up story. This is something that very practically could actually work. Now you go, but wait a minute, boats usually have a front and a tail and a sail, and no, they weren't going anywhere. They didn't need to navigate. They just needed to survive. So God says, here's what I want you to do. And so Noah begins to build this ark. Now, right away, you might go, this sounds crazy. How in the world? Because God says, take two of every animal, every species, and put them in the ark. And then later he says, oh, and get seven pairs of clean animals and birds, because later they would be used for sacrifices and perhaps for food as well. So you go, that doesn't sound very plausible. Well, think about it. With these sizes, three decks, you have over 100,000 square feet of floor space and fairly high ceilings. They could be stacked. They could be in layers. So ultimately, though, the people have calculated that the capacity, the space of the ark, is about the same as like 586 railroad boxcars. That's a lot. You could put this many animals. When they take and calculate how many animals was this actually, two of each kind, seven of some, you go, how many species are there? Well, even speculating, now a lot of species exist in the water just fine, so the vast majority of species wouldn't need to be in the ark, but the ones that would, somebody has estimated that about 50,000 animals at the max. That means if every extinct species that we know was included. And they said that for all of those, the space they would take would be about 37% of the ark, essentially one floor. Now, of course, also, you're not going to bring, if you're going to go, okay, I need two elephants, you're not going to get the biggest elephants, you're going to get baby elephants. If there's an animal that comes in an egg, you're going to take the eggs. Now, also, there are people who study genetics who say that most species have within it the traces of a capacity to hibernate. And it's just that over time, that hasn't been necessary. So God could have put all these animals to sleep. They're going to need a lot less to eat and everything like that. There are all sorts of possibilities. This is not ridiculous. This is not, I mean, if they take up about a third of the ark, the food takes up another third and provides a layer between all the refuse in the bottom floor with the animals and where the people live up on the top, the people are going to have more room on the ark than any of us have in our houses. And so this sounds realistic. It really could be, I believe. You don't have to believe it, but it makes sense. If you were going to do something like this, this is exactly the way you could do it. Now, it began to rain. Once they got in there and God closed the door, and can you imagine, they've never really seen rain. They don't know what it is to float around in a boat. They had no doubt seen the ocean because, you know, the earth is mostly covered with water. So they knew what water was. They probably knew what a boat was. But for the water to come where they were was something that would have been kind of spooky. And plus, all the people of the culture around were laughing at them, no doubt, and going, "You've been talking about this for 100 years. This is not going to happen." And maybe even for Noah's kids and especially the in-laws, they're going, "What are we thinking?" This is because really it says Noah was the only guy who was really righteous. So they're sort of going along with him just to keep the family peace. But they're all probably thinking, this isn't going to happen, but what's it going to hurt if we do it? So they're crowding around on the boat, and then the door is closed. Nothing. But then gradually it starts to rain. They had never really experienced rain the way that they were at this point. Now, it's possible and probably even likely that the earth had a water canopy around it. That's not unheard of astronomically. So if the planet was protected by a water canopy, that would explain how you could live so long, why a 500-year-old guy is having kids. Our bodies are actually constructed to easily last 1,000 years if we don't get infected from something from without, such as the sun. Pretty hard to stay out of the sun. You can use sunscreen, but the ultraviolet rays and everything that get into our atmosphere, what ages us. But if there was a water canopy, you have protection, and that's not happening. Well, now they're getting in the boat, and as it describes, we'll look at chapter 7, verse 11. It says, "In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened." Now, remember, in our creation account, we saw this massive of water that was then separated to create the atmosphere. And it says that the firmament was the space between the water and the water. So now, if that starts busting up, can you imagine the moisture, the rain that could have poured on them at this point, and if the windows of heaven really were open. Now look over at verse 17. "Now the flood was on the earth 40 days. The waters increased and lifted up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. The waters prevailed and greatly increased on the earth, and the ark moved about on the surface of the waters, and the waters prevailed exceedingly on the earth, and all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed 15 cubits, or, you know, 27 feet or so up above the height of the mountains. They were covered." So they get in a boat, bunch of animals, a lot of food, close the door. Water is just pouring down. And it's a major, major flood where they're floating, and pretty soon it's like, there's no mountaintops left. We're actually up above the highest mountaintop. And this lasted. They stayed on the ark for a little over a year, if you add it all up. Does this sound ridiculous in a way? Like, even with a water canopy, where are you going to get that much water? Well, it's funny, we think like that. And there are some people who go, "I couldn't believe that because there's just not enough water to cover the highest mountains in the world." Are you kidding me? There's enough water easily to do that. I mean, you understand, 2/3 of the world is covered with water, right? Well, that water is not all 5 feet deep. It's not the shallow end. There are places where under the sea are hugely deep. The Mariana Trench, 6.7 miles deep that we know of. Now, the highest mountain in the world, Mount Everest, is only 5.5 miles high. And there's a lot more of the trench than there is of Everest. So what happens is, first of all, we don't know that the mountains were always as high as they are. Because, for instance, if there was a catastrophe like this, the runoff of the water would have made big mountains. We've seen that happen with seismic activity, where tectonic plates begin to shift, and all of a sudden, volcanic stuff comes out, and you have a mountain where you used to have a valley. And then you have a valley where you used to have a mountain. These kinds of shifts aren't that hard. Well, if you just took all the deep parts of the sea and you lifted them up, and you took mountains and lowered them a little bit, all the water in the world, and this isn't counting a vapor barrier, this is just water that we now have on the earth, could cover the entire globe 1.7 miles deep. So there's a lot of water there. And so if, number one, if the valleys weren't as deep and the mountains weren't as high in those days, which is easily plausible, all we know is the water got above that mountain. So if that mountain wasn't that big and those valleys weren't that deep, no problem with a little bit of shifting of the tectonic plates, which, again, in those days, Earth is fairly young. It's before now. There could have been incredible activity to do something like that. It wouldn't take much. We have seen entire islands just covered. It happens. And we've seen valleys turn into lakes and vice versa. So here, what he says happened easily could have happened. So don't say, I don't believe in this because that just sounds preposterous. No, it's totally logical. You read mythology, and they're always saying things that are ridiculous that could have never happened. You read the Bible, and you go, wow, sounds like a story, but this could actually have happened. It could have happened. It could happen again. And if you have that kind of water movement from huge, you know, geologic shifts, then when the water runs off, it's going to create the Grand Canyon. It's going to create all sorts of, you know, things that look like they might have taken millions of years to make. But no, you can make them really quick with enough water moving fast enough. And all of a sudden you find out, wow, there's some mountains that are way higher than they used to be. And there's some valleys that are way deeper. So the flood is described, and it's like this huge flushing of the world. Now, how do we know that this is the whole earth? And I hear people argue about this. There are some people who say, I believe in a flood, but I think it was probably a local flood. Because, you know, all it would have had to do, all the people in the world lived in a pretty small area at that time. And so all you had to do is wipe out them. It could have just been a part of the planet that was flooded. Now, not only do we see geologically evidence of everything having been underwater at one time or another, no one really contends with that. There's a logical problem I have with a local flood. And that is, why would you have a guy spend 100 years to build a boat? Have him build a trailer and take his stuff over to the next valley. I mean, it's true, the Hebrew word eretz, or that's land or earth, most of the time it's used, it just refers to a small area, a city, a country, or whatever. It can refer to both. But logically, if the intent of God is to start civilization over, it at least had to flood everywhere where people were. Now, we're not going to, on a Sunday morning, go into the story of the Tower of Babel. I originally was doing it, and then I figured I have 87 studies for 52 weeks, so it's one of the ones that didn't make the cut this week. But at the Tower of Babel, the people are all gathering together in one small place. They all wanted to be together. And God ends up changing their languages so that they would spread out. See, God doesn't desire for all people to get together all the time. He told them again and again, I want you to spread out. Now, it could be that what happened in the flood opened up pathways for all sorts of other areas of the earth to be populated. Most evil things start in cities, not in the countryside. And so God may have used the flood as a way to spread them out as well. At any rate, the flood, you know, the rain stopped after 40 days and 40 nights, and you know probably the story. They were waiting and waiting, didn't see any mountains, and at some point the thing kind of touched down. They felt them touch solid land on Mount Ararat in present-day Turkey. So he's like, well, let's see what's out there. And he sends a bird, a raven out, and it flies all over the place and can't find a place to even land. So they wait a while. Another week later, he takes a dove. He sends the dove out. The dove flies around, comes back. Then he waits a while more, and he sends the dove back out. And this time, he came back with a little leaf in his mouth. And he's like, okay, there's dry land somewhere, and it's growing. It's lush. And so he waits another week, sends the dove out, and the dove doesn't come back. So then he's going, okay, this is great. And God says, it's time to get out. It's time to get out of the ark. I'm sure this was good news. Living in essentially a huge floating barn for a year with your relatives. I'm sure it was like, woohoo! So they get out, and they must have seen the most incredible sight. Because think about the whole earth being irrigated, and then the water soaks in, and these plants are coming to life, and it's just awesome. The animals are so excited to get off the boat, and so are Noah and his family, and it's like, man, this is a fresh start. And it felt more exciting than just about anything that we can imagine. They stepped off the ark. And so at that point, God just made a few points with them. And we just need to think about these. First of all, he said, go multiply the people and the animals. Just go fill the earth. Your task now is to start civilization all over again and hopefully to do it differently than you did before. So go and multiply. That's a pretty cool commandment, actually. Now, I don't think necessarily he would say the same thing today, because I think we've pretty much covered the multiplication thing, but that was his word to them. But the second thing was, he said, now the animals are going to be skittish. They're going to be afraid of people. And that's kind of interesting as a consequence of the flood. Gives us some insight into perhaps the relationship that people had with animals. Maybe it's one reason why it was easy enough to get two of each of them on the ark, because they didn't have this hostile environment between them. But now God says, the animals aren't going to like you anymore. And it could be that going back to whatever gross perversions they were into, that somehow animals were involved, either as an object of their worship or as someone who was a role model for how you should live your life, like an animal. We don't know. But he said, this time around, you and the animals aren't going to be such good buddies. Remember way back in the Garden of Eden, it was Eve talking to a snake that caused everything to kind of deteriorate and go downhill. And now he's saying, the animals aren't on your side anymore. Now, I'm not going to take this and teach you that you shouldn't have a dog and dress him up in a sweater, but I'm just saying. God said, it's not natural. But then he goes also, and this is kind of weird, he says, and by the way, not only the animals are afraid of you, they have a good reason, because they're edible. Now, before this, they didn't eat animals. But now God goes, have a burger. You know, starting the world over, you're going to do it right. Probably with the atmospheric change, might have been more necessary to get some of the nutrients that you'd find in meat and some of the proteins and everything that you would need that maybe they didn't need beforehand. But again, all you animal lovers, this is what it says. I'm just telling you the story. He says, go ahead, get off the boat, make babies, and you're going to have to chase an animal before you eat it. So, you know, that's kind of, you know, what he lays out there. But he also says that you also need to have something different here. You're going to have the death penalty now. If a man sheds blood, by man will his blood be shed. Why would you institute this kind of criminal law at a time like this? Obviously, they didn't really have that strict of a police control before this. And so you could kill people without a penalty. Well, now he says even, hey, if an animal kills a person, kill the animal. But he's going, if a person kills a person, kill them. Now, that just seems so hostile to us. And for many of us, maybe in our mentalities, we may think, man, I love people so much, I'm totally against the death penalty, I'm totally against criminal sentences for people who do bad things. That's kind of the way our society is developing. And I'm not all gung-ho death penalty, because as I see the death penalty as it's executed today, it's all dumb people and poor people who get executed. If you're rich enough to hire a good lawyer, it doesn't happen to you. And that's certainly a problem. But what God is saying is, we'll be right back where we started from if somebody won't step up and say, sometimes somebody has to die or we will all die. This is theoretically what a just war is about. It's like the object of war is to kill people. But if the object of war is to kill people, if you are killing people who will kill you if you don't kill them, it actually saves society by allowing parts of society to have to be destroyed. That's what the flood did. And the more we get to the point where we're not comfortable with this, the more we believe that it's like live and let live and, you know, oh, let's give them another chance and everything, then the worse our society becomes. The greater the problems that we deal with, it's just going to be that way, because we aren't willing to say, look, to a criminal, to a habitual criminal, to go, you know what, I know you've got problems. I know you had a bad father. I know you've got all kinds of genetic stuff going on, and you have ADD and everything. But sometimes you just got to lean in over the plate and take one for the home team, because if you're allowed to continue to do what you're doing, you will destroy humanity. And so you're either put in a warehouse, or you're put out of your misery, or what we have is a world that's totally out of control, like the world before the flood. See what I'm saying? That some people have to die in order for everyone to end up living. And so he lays that out. And then the last thing that God did in this little orientation to the new earth was to say, by the way, look at that rainbow in the sky. Now, they had never seen a rainbow before. If my postulation is correct that there was this water canopy around the earth, the potential for a rainbow to develop wouldn't have happened there. See, a rainbow happens because rays of the sun shine into a drop of rain, which they wouldn't have had at that time, and then a drop of rain acts as a prism and disperses the light into the different colors, and that's how it works. So this is the first rainbow they've ever seen, but God says, whenever you see that rainbow, I want you to remember that I'm promising you this is the last time I'm going to destroy the earth with a flood. So it's God's faithfulness to say, I had to do this once. The next time I do it, it will be final. But right now, you don't get all freaked out about, oh no, the world is going to end, we're going to destroy ourselves. Growing up as a kid, in my generation, in my era, we believed that the Russians were going to be bombing us. I mean, we didn't know they were so drunk on vodka they aren't even capable of flying a fighter plane. But, sorry if you're Russian. I know not all Russians. But I mean, we used to duck down. They would blow a horn in school, and we would duck down under these, you know, Masonite desks and cover our eyes thinking that that would stop us from a nuclear holocaust. It just made you feel better to be afraid all the time of something, you know, that wasn't going to happen anyway. God didn't want people to live with that kind of fear. Like, oh, when's the next flood coming? When's the next catastrophe happening? No, what God wanted his people to wait for is for him to show up and change everything. For the promise of Genesis 3, the seed of woman who would destroy the enemy. That's what they should be looking forward to, not further destruction. He won't do this again. As much as it seems like it would be warranted, God promised. And the rainbow reminds us of that all the time. So, you know, what do we take away from this story? It's a cool story. It's a story that I believe. What do we take away from it? First of all, I love the fact that God keeps his promises. In fact, again, a promise to say a seed of woman will someday destroy the devil. the one who messed everything up, the one who's responsible for all of it. God goes, I will do anything I have to do, including after long warnings, destroying most of the people who I love. Because if they keep destroying each other, that promise will not be fulfilled. So we're going to go Earth 2.0, and we're going to just have to start all over. That's how, even though God was so sorry, even though this was difficult for him, God always keeps his promises. Now, God has promised certain things to us. God will not let anyone, hell or high water, stop him from doing what he says he's going to do. And so I know, when he says that he's going to bring good out of everything that happens to me, I'm just crazy enough to believe him because I've seen how he handles his other promises. When he says someday he's going to come back and he's going to destroy all evil and give us a fresh start, I believe him because God absolutely keeps his promises. Another thing that I think we just need to remember from this story, and it's introduced at the beginning, and you don't have a lot said about it after that. God feels. I mean, that's presented as this is how it affected him. This is how he felt when he was doing what he felt. Now, for us, theologically, sometimes we're like, no. God can't feel because, I mean, that would make him like a human. He created us in his image. The only reason it's a problem for God to be torn or for God to feel is if we think feelings are bad. If you think feeling something is wrong or you think being conflicted on something is bad, then yeah, we have to ignore what it says about God here because he is presented as being torn. But the truth is, we're all torn. We're all in situations all the time where it's like, I think I know what I'm supposed to do, but I'm not sure, and oh, this is going to be hard, and I kind of don't want to do. I mean, that dominates our lives. It is not a life of complete clarity. It's a life in which we are torn, and I think God here in the story lets us know sometimes you have to watch something that you love be destroyed. Sometimes you have to do something that it doesn't feel good to do it, but you just know this is what I have to do. And so I love that about this story. I personally love reading about a God who feels. Now, another thing you see in the story is there's all these people and only one good one. And the truth is, ever since then, even as his family developed, the majority of people are generally bad. If you live your life with an assumption that most people are good, man is basically good, you're going to be disappointed over and over again. Because the truth is, if you are sincere and good and right and you really want the right things, you're in a minority. It always cracks me up when Christians try to organize as if most people are good, so we're the moral majority. The majority of people are really moral. No, they aren't. Even the majority of the moral majority wasn't good. They had other reasons for wanting what they wanted. Majority's wrong. I had a professor back at Biola who used to say, in the beginning, there were two people, and they were both wrong. They took a vote, and they were both wrong, and the majority has been wrong ever since. If you're going to be a godly person, if you're going to be a good person, you need to realize you're going to be surrounded by people who aren't. And so you just need to expect that. Don't get your hopes up that somebody who, because they say, yep, I'm one of the good guys, don't assume that they're going to be one of the good guys. You look at some of the horrible things that people get themselves into because they're so trusting, and then they link their life to someone, they get married, they become friends, only to be stabbed in the back, you realize, hey, this is just the way it is. The earth is deteriorating because people are trying to destroy other people, and people just want what they want. Our job is to make sure that with all of that and realizing that, and I mean, I look at a room this size, I can't imagine how much sin is in this room right now, but but my challenge is, if God looks here, is he going to go, and you're one of the good guys. You really are. You really want this. You're real. You're not faking it. But if you're that person, you're going to be a minority. And when you get out, you might even be a minority in this room, but when you get out of here, when we go away from here, we've got to expect the trends are pretty much the same. If you make decisions based on what other people think you ought to do, you'll be wrong most of the time. So you have to be able to be the guy who's pounding away, building a boat when everybody thinks it's ridiculous. Still doing faithfully what you're doing when most people would say that's a waste of your time and energy and, you know, everyone's laughing at you. This story lets me know I better not expect a bunch of peer pressure to help me to do the right thing. I'm going to have to stand up alone if necessary to do what's right. And then ultimately, as I think of this story, I'm kind of fascinated. God could have killed people in any number of ways. He could have sent a plague. He's done that before. He could have just blinked his eyes and everyone would just die. He could have taken away the oxygen. He could have, you know, just brought global warming and just toasted everyone. All sorts of ways he could have done this. But he chose water, which is significant to me. Because water, which is where the Bible teaches that life began in the water, the first creatures that were created were in the water. Water is something that our bodies are mostly composed of water. That's what we're all made of. Water is essential. Now, I sometimes think, I don't know what I would do if God sent me to live somewhere where there's no water, there's no ocean. I mean, I don't know if I'm sitting in the middle of a wheat field in Kansas, if I'm just going to turn on a faucet and just watch the water. But for me, water is essential to my feeling like I'm in touch with what's going on. Now, again, whether it's a mountain stream or something like that, water is, you can't live without it. So God used that. Why? The Bible talks about water in the aspect of cleansing often. The Holy Spirit's even referred to in that way. See, what God was doing to the earth, and I think it was very important, is he was actually cleaning it up. He was giving it a bath. He was rushing water over it in order for it to truly have a fresh start. Now, in our lives, the same thing happens. Sometimes God sends a flood. It feels like a flood. Some of the hardest times in your life, I bet you felt like you were going to drown. It was like, I don't even know, I'm fighting for the surface. One thing after another happens to you, and you're like, ah. But can you understand that God does that to cleanse us? He does it for our good. He does that to protect and preserve us. But we don't like to be cleaned. We don't like for things in our lives to be washed away. I mean, sometimes you have a sense of feeling that, oh, man, it's like a flood. I had this friend or I had this lover or whatever, and whoosh, they're just washed out of my life. You realize what a blessing that can be, how important it is? Or you look at the stuff that you have, and you go, oh, no, I lost a bunch of money. I lost a bunch of stuff. My car's wrecked. You ever think maybe some of those things are what's holding you back and that God just wants to wash it away and give you a fresh start? Wouldn't you love your life to be like the earth when they stepped off the ark and it's green and lush and now you don't have a big house, you're not rich, you don't have a big history, you don't have any friends, but you've got a fresh start. A lot of times God wants to do that for us. I don't like for someone to clean me. I remember when I was a kid, you know, my mom, before we're going into church or whatever, she's like spitting on her hand and wiping on my head, and I didn't like that. My granddaughter, Sadie, last Sunday, I got to babysit her because Ann had a women's function or something. And so normally on Sunday afternoons, I take a nap. But I had Sadie. And she's so cute. I mean, she plays really well by herself, but she wants me to be awake. So every once in a while, I just feel her hand on me. So by the time everyone got there and it was dinner time, I was exhausted. And Ann made some Mexican food, and I'm just sitting here like this at the table, just with my hand on my face. Well, Sadie was sitting next to me, and she had just been eating refried beans. So she sees me doing that, and she just takes her hands and and her face was covered with beans. So cute. Anne's like taking pictures and everything. But then we had to clean the beans off. Now, from her perspective, no, you don't. I might eat them later. You don't know. And I look fine to me. But you go, nah, we got to clean these beans off. We're that way with our lives. We're like little kids who don't want to be cleaned up. Can we believe that when we lose something, that God actually was washing it away, that he was giving us a fresh start? That's what he did here, and that's what he's doing for us. So expect floods in your life. Expect some things that you're hanging on to that you think are so secure. And sometimes every once in a while, it's just flush. Whoosh, it's just washed away. And you'll find that the world that results from that is going to be way better than that destructive world that you're hanging on to. It really is. It can be such a fresh start if we understand that God, with the washing of his water, including his word that's called water, that he brings us from a place where if it kept going like this, we might destroy ourselves. So he says, here you go, fresh start. And I love that. If you're here today and you don't have really any kind of a connection with God at all, I think God probably pushed you here for a reason. Because your life, it's been messed up. You realize that. You're victimized. Everything's awful. It's not working for you. And yet the last thing you want to do is let go of the last few things that you're hanging on to. God wants to start over with you. He may want to take more things out of your life to save you, but he wants to save you. He wants you to last. He wants you to experience a fresh start and just the water coming over you and then the green and the growth and everything that he can do. And the way you do that is by coming to him and saying, I need that. See, God sent his son Jesus to die for you. The reason the flood happened was so that a righteous seed would be able to continue through civilization until it was time for Jesus to be born. He gave his son for you. Jesus died for you so that you can start over. And what that means is you give your life to him, and it's like you're stepping off the ark. I get to start fresh. And if that's something that you need, if that's something you want to do, if you're really tired of living in a place where it's just dog eat dog, you want a fresh start, he can do that for you. There'll be people down here in the front who just love to pray for you for any reason, but especially to introduce you into a relationship with the Lord. And for all of us this week, there's going to be water. There's going to be little storms. Nothing that's going to destroy us. God promised he won't do that. But you can fight against the waves that come into your life, or you can paddle and ride them and realize that God's going to put you in a better place. And so let's look for that. Let's just be willing to let go of anything that might kill us. And let's start fresh this week. Let's pray. Lord, thanks for this story. And we're sorry when we think of it as being a fake one. The more we read it, the more we look at it, the more we realize how plausible it is and how necessary it was. But God, help us to submit to you, to allow you to coop us up with a bunch of animals and dung and everything for a while in order for us to get out and see the new green earth where we can be productive. Lord, for people who don't know you, help them to realize there is no hope without you. Even though most people agree with them, most people are wrong. Give them the faith to start life over with you. We thank you, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.